The guardian must warn him not to go a step further unless he feels in himself the strength to fulfill the demands made in the above speech. However horrible the form assumed by the guardian, it is only the effect of the student's own past life, his own character risen out of him into independent existence. This awakening is brought about by the separation of will, thought, and feeling. To feel for the first time that one has oneself called a spiritual being into existence is in itself an experience of the deepest significance. The student's preparation must aim at enabling him to endure the terrible sight without a trace of timidity, and at the moment of the meeting to feel his strength so increased that he can undertake fully conscious the responsibility for transforming and beautifying the guardian. If successful, this meeting with the guardian results in the student's next physical death being an entirely different event from death as he knew it formerly. He experiences death consciously by laying aside the physical body as one discards a garment that is worn out or perhaps rendered useless through a sudden rent. Thus his physical death is of special importance only for those living with him whose perception is still restricted to the world of the senses. For them the student dies, but for himself nothing of importance is changed in his whole environment. The entire supersensible world stood open to him before his death, and it is this same world that now confronts him after death. The guardian of the threshold is also connected with other matters. The person belongs to a family, a nation, a race. His activity in this world depends upon his belonging to some such community. His individual character is also connected with it. The conscious activity of individual persons by no means exhausts everything to be reckoned with in a family, a nation, or a race. Besides their character, families, nations, and races have also their destiny. For persons restricted to their senses, these things remain mere general ideas, and the materialistic thinker in his prejudice will look down with contempt on the spiritual scientist when he hears that for him, family and national character, lineal or racial destiny, are vested in beings just as real as the personality in which the character and destiny of the individual man are vested. The spiritual scientist becomes acquainted with higher worlds of which the separate personalities are members, just as arms and legs are members of the human being. Besides the separate individuals, a very real family and national group soul and racial spirit is at work in the life of a family, a people, or a race. Indeed, in a certain sense, the separate individuals are merely the executive organs of these family group souls, racial spirits, and so on. It is nothing but the truth to say, for instance, that a national group soul makes use of each individual man belonging to that nation for the execution of some work. The group soul of a people does not descend into physical reality, but dwells in higher worlds, and in order to work in the physical world, makes use of the physical organs of each individual human being. In a higher sense, it is like an architect making use of workmen for executing the details of a building. In the truest sense, everyone receives his allotted task from his family, national or racial group soul. Now the ordinary person is by no means initiated into the higher design of his work. He joins unconsciously in the tasks of his people and of his race. From the moment the student meets the guardian, he must not only know his own tasks, but must knowingly collaborate in those of his folk, his race. Every extension of his horizon necessarily enlarges the scope of his duties. What actually happens is that the student adds a new body to his finer soul body. He puts on a second garment. Hitherto he found his way through the world with the coverings enveloping his personality, and what he had to accomplish for his community, his nation, his race, was directed by higher spirits who made use of his personality. And now a further revelation made to him by the guardian of the threshold is that henceforth these spirits will withdraw their guiding hand from him. He must step out of the circle of his community. Yet as an isolated personality he would become hardened in himself and decline into ruin did he not himself acquire those powers which are vested in the national and racial spirits. Many no doubt will say, quote, "Oh, I have entirely freed myself from all lineal and racial connections. I only want to be a human being and nothing but a human being," unquote. To these one must reply, quote, "Who then brought you to this freedom? Was it not your family who placed you in the world where you now stand? Have you not your lineage, your nation, your race to thank for being what you are? They have brought you up, and if now exalted above all prejudices, you are one of the light-bringers and benefactors of your stock and even of your race, it is to their upbringing that you owe it. Yes, even when you say you are, quote, nothing but a human being, unquote, even the fact that you have become such a personality, you owe to the spirits of your communities, unquote. Only the esoteric student learns what it means to be entirely cut off from his family, national, or racial spirit. He alone realizes, through personal experience, the insignificance of all such education in respect of the life now confronting him. For everything inculcated by education completely melts away when the threads binding will, thought, and feeling are severed. He looks back on the result of all his previous education as he might on a house crumbling away brick by brick, which he must now rebuild in a new form. And again, it is more than a mere symbolical expression to say that when the guardian has enunciated his first statement, there arises from the spot where he stands a whirlwind which extinguishes all those spiritual lights that have hitherto illumined the pathway of his life. Utter darkness, relieved only by the rays issuing from the guardian himself, unfolds before the student. And out of this darkness resounds the guardian's further admonition. Quote, "Step not across my threshold until thou dost clearly realize that thou wilt thyself illumine the darkness ahead of thee. Take not a single step forward until thou art positive that thou hast sufficient oil in thine own lamp. The lamps of the guides whom thou hast hitherto followed will now no longer be available to thee." Unquote. At these words the student must turn and glance backward. The guardian of the threshold now draws aside a veil which till now had concealed deep life mysteries. The family, national, and racial spirits are revealed to the student in their full activity, so that he perceives clearly, on the one hand, how he has hitherto been led, and no less clearly, on the other hand, that he will henceforward no longer enjoy this guidance. That is the second warning received at the threshold from its guardian. Without preparation, no one could endure the sight of what has here been indicated. But the higher training which makes it possible at all for the student to advance up to the threshold simultaneously puts him in a position to find the necessary strength at the right moment. Indeed, the training can be so harmonious in its nature that the entry into the higher life is relieved of everything of an agitating or tumultuous character. His experience at the threshold will then be attended by a premonition of that felicity which is to provide the keynote of his newly awakened life. The feeling of a new freedom will outweigh all other feelings, and attended by this feeling, his new duties and responsibilities will appear as something which man at a particular stage of life must needs take upon himself. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10, Life and Death, the Greater Guardian of the Threshold. I'm on page 245. It has been described in the foregoing chapter how significant for the human being is his meeting with the so-called lesser guardian of the threshold by virtue of the fact that he becomes aware of confronting a supersensible being whom he has himself brought into existence and whose body consists of the hitherto invisible results of the student's own actions, feelings, and thoughts. These unseen forces have become the cause of his destiny and his character, and he realizes how he himself founded the present in the past. He can understand why his inner self, now standing to a certain extent revealed before him, includes particular inclinations and habits, and he can also recognize the origin of certain blows of fate that have befallen him. He perceives why he loves one thing and hates another, why one thing makes him happy and another unhappy. Visible life is explained by the invisible causes. The essential facts of life, too, health and illness, birth and death, unveil themselves before his gaze. He observes how before his birth he wove the causes which necessarily led to his return into life. Henceforth he knows that being within himself which is fashioned with all its imperfections in the visible world, and which can only be brought to its final perfection in this same visible world. For in no other world is an opportunity given to build up and complete this being. Moreover, he recognizes that death cannot sever him forever from this world, for he says to himself, quote, "Once I came into this world because, being what I was, I needed the life it provided to acquire qualities unattainable in any other world, and I must remain bound to this world until I have developed within myself everything that can here be gained. I shall some day become a useful collaborator in another world only by acquiring all the requisite faculties in this physical world." Unquote. Thanks to his insight into the supersensible world, the initiate gains a better knowledge and appreciation of the true value of visible nature than was possible before his higher training. And this may be counted among his most important experiences. Anyone not possessing this insight, and perhaps, therefore, imagining the supersensible regions to be infinitely more valuable, is likely to underestimate the physical world. Yet the possessor of this insight knows that without experience in visible reality, he would be totally powerless in that other invisible reality. Before he can live in the latter, he must have the requisite faculties and instruments which can only be acquired in the visible world. Consciousness in the invisible world is not possible without spiritual sight, but this power of vision in the higher world is gradually developed through experience in the lower. No one can be born in the spiritual world with spiritual eyes without having first developed them in the physical world, any more than a child could be born with physical eyes had they not already been formed within the mother's womb. From this standpoint, it will also be readily understood why the threshold to the supersensible world is watched over by a guardian. In no case may real insight into those regions be permitted to anyone lacking the requisite faculties. Therefore, when at the hour of death anyone enters the other world while still incompetent to work in it, the higher experiences are shrouded from him until he is fit to behold them. When the student enters the supersensible world, life acquires quite a new meaning for him. He discerns in the physical world the seed ground of a higher world, so that in a certain sense the higher will appear defective without the lower. Two outlooks are opened before him, the first into the past and the second into the future. His vision extends to a past in which this physical world was not yet existent, for he has long since discarded the prejudice that the supersensible world was developed out of the sense world. He knows that the former existed first, and that out of it everything physical was evolved. He sees that he himself belonged to a supersensible world before coming for the first time into this sense world. But this pristine supersensible world needed to pass through the sense world, for without this passage, its further evolution would not have been possible. It can only pursue its course when certain beings will have developed requisite faculties within the realm of the senses. These beings are none other than human beings. They owe their present life to an imperfect stage of spiritual existence, and are being led even within this stage to that perfection which will make them fit for further work in the higher world. At this point, the outlook is directed into the future. A higher stage of the supersensible world is discerned, which will contain the fruits matured in the sense world. The sense world, as such, will be overcome, but its results will be embodied in a higher world. The existence of disease and death in the sense world is thus explained. Death merely expresses the fact that the original supersensible world reached a point beyond which it could not progress by itself. Universal death must needs have overtaken it, had it not received a fresh life impulse. Thus this new life has evolved into a battle with universal death. From the remnants of a dying, rigid world, there sprouted the seeds of a new one. That is why we have death and life in the world. The decaying portion of the old world adheres to the new life blossoming from it, and the process of evolution moves slowly. This comes to expression most clearly in man himself. The sheath he bears is gathered from the preserved remnants of the old world, and within this sheath the germ of that being is matured which will live in the future. Thus man is twofold, mortal and immortal. The mortal is in its last, the immortal in its first stage. But it is only within this twofold world, which finds its expression in the sense world, that he can acquire the requisite faculties to lead the world to immortality. Indeed, his task is precisely to gather the fruits of the mortal for the immortal. And as he glances at himself as the result of his own work in the past, he cannot but say, quote, "I have in me the elements of a decaying world. They are at work in me, and I can only break their power little by little, thanks to the new immortal elements coming to life within me." Unquote. This is the path leading man from life to death. Excuse me. This is the path leading man from death to life. Could he but speak to himself with full consciousness, at the hour of his death, he would say, quote, "The perishing world was my taskmaster. I am now dying as the result of the entire past in which I am enmeshed. Yet the soil of mortal life has matured the seeds of immortal life. I carry them with me into another world. If it had merely depended on the past, I could never have been born. The life of the past came to an end with birth. Life in the sense world is wrested from universal death by the newly formed life germ. The time between birth and death is merely an expression for the sum of values wrested from the dying past by the new life. And illness is nothing but the continued effect of the dying portions of the past." Unquote. In the above, the answer will be found to the question why man works his way only gradually through error and imperfection to the good and true. His actions, feelings, and thoughts are at first dominated by the perishing and the mortal. The latter gave rise to his sense organs. For this reason, these organs and all things activating them are doomed to perish. The imperishable will not be found in the instincts, impulses, and passions, or in the organs belonging to them, but only in the work produced by these organs. Man must extract from the perishable everything that can be extracted, and this work alone will enable him to discard the background out of which he has grown, and which finds its expression in the physical sense world. Thus the first guardian confronts man as the counterpart of his twofold nature, in which perishable and imperishable are blended. And it stands clearly proved how far removed he still is from attaining the sublime, luminous figure which may again dwell in the pure spiritual world. The extent to which he is entangled in the physical sense world is exposed to the student's view. The presence of instincts, impulses, desires, egotistical wishes, and all forms of selfishness, and so forth, expresses itself in this entanglement, as it does further in his membership in a race, a nation, and so forth. For peoples and races are but steps leading to pure humanity. A race or a nation stands so much the higher, the more perfectly its members express the pure ideal human type. The further they have worked their way from the physical and perishable to the supersensible and imperishable. The evolution of man through the incarnations in ever higher national and racial forms is thus a process of liberation. Man must finally appear in harmonious perfection. In a similar way, the pilgrimage through ever purer forms of morality and religion is a perfecting process, for every moral stage retains the passion for the perishable beside the seeds of an ideal future. Now, in the guardian of the threshold, as described above, the product of the past is manifest, containing only so many seeds of the future as could be planted in the course of time. Yet everything that can be extracted from the sense world must be carried into the supersensible world. Were man to bring with him only what had been woven into his counterpart out of the past, his earthly task would remain but partially accomplished. For this reason, the lesser guardian of the threshold is joined after a time by the greater guardian. The meeting with the second guardian will again be described in narrative form. When the student has recognized all the elements from which he must liberate himself, his way is barred by a sublime, luminous being, whose beauty is difficult to describe in the words of human language. This encounter takes place when the sundering of the organs of thinking, feeling, and willing extends to the physical body, so that their reciprocal connection is no longer regulated by themselves, but by the higher consciousness, which has now entirely liberated itself from physical conditions. The organs of thinking, feeling, and willing will then be controlled from supersensible regions as instruments in the power of the human soul. The latter, thus liberated from all physical bonds, is now confronted by the second guardian of the threshold, who speaks as follows, quote, "Thou hast revealed thyself from the world of the senses. Thou hast won the right to become a citizen of the supersensible world, whence thine activity can now be directed. For thine own sake thou dost no longer require thy physical body in its present form. If thine intention were merely to acquire the faculties necessary for life in the supersensible world, thou needest no longer return to the sense world. But now behold me. See how sublimely I tower above all that thou hast made of thyself thus far. Thou hast attained thy present degree of perfection thanks to the faculties thou wert able to develop in the sense world, as long as thou wert still confined to it. But now a new era is to begin, in which thy liberated powers must be applied to further work in the world of the senses. Hitherto thou hast sought only thine own release, but now having thyself become free, thou canst go forth as a liberator of thy fellows. Until today thou hast striven as an individual, but now seek to coordinate thyself with the whole, so that thou mayst bring into the supersensible world not thyself alone, but all things else existing in the world of the senses. Thou wilt some day be able to unite with me, but I cannot be blessed so long as others remain unredeemed. As a separate freed being, thou wouldest fain enter at once the kingdom of the supersensible, yet thou wouldest be forced to look down on the still unredeemed beings in the physical world, having sundered thy destiny from theirs, although thou and they are inseparably united. Ye all did perforce descend into the sense world to gather powers needed for a higher world. To separate thyself from thy fellows would mean to abuse those very powers which thou couldst not have developed, save in their company. Thou couldst not have descended, had they not done so. And without them the powers needed for supersensible existence would fail thee. Thou must now share with thy fellows the powers which together with them thou didst acquire. I shall therefore bar thine entry into the higher regions of the supersensible world, so long as thou hast not applied all the powers thou hast acquired to the liberation of thy companions. With the powers already at thy disposal, thou mayest sojourn in the lower regions of the supersensible world, but I stand before the portal of the higher regions as the cherub with the fiery sword before paradise, and I bar thine entrance as long as powers unused in the sense world still remain in thee. And if thou dost refuse to apply thy powers in this world, others will come who will not refuse, and a higher supersensible world will receive all the fruits of the sense world, while thou wilt lose from under thy feet the very ground in which thou wert rooted. The purified world will develop above and beyond thee, and thou shalt be excluded from it. Thus thou wouldest tread the black path, while the others from whom thou didst sever thyself tread the white path. Unquote. With these words the greater guardian makes his presence known, soon after the meeting with the first guardian has taken place. The initiate knows full well what is in store for him, if he yields to the temptation of a premature abode in the supersensible world. An indescribable splendor shines forth from the second guardian of the threshold. Union with him looms as a far distant ideal before the soul's vision. Yet there is also the certitude that this union will not be possible until all the powers afforded by this world are applied to the task of its liberation and redemption. By fulfilling the demands of the higher light being, the initiate will contribute to the liberation of the human race. He lays his gifts on the sacrificial altar of humanity. Should he prefer his own premature elevation into the supersensible world, the stream of human evolution will flow over and past him. After his liberation, he can gain no new powers from the world of the senses, and if he places his work at the world's disposal, it will entail his renouncement of any further benefit for himself. It does not follow that when called upon to decide, anyone will naturally follow the white path. That depends entirely upon whether he is so far purified at the time of his decision that no trace of self-seeking makes this prospect of felicity appear desirable. For the allurements here are the strongest possible, whereas on the other side no special allurements are evident. Here nothing appeals to his egotism. The gift he receives in the higher regions of the supersensible world is nothing that comes to him, but only something that flows from him, that is love for the world and for his fellows. Nothing that egotism desires is denied upon the black path, for the latter provides, on the contrary, for the complete gratification of egotism, and will not fail to attract those desiring merely their own felicity, for it is indeed the appropriate path for them. No one, therefore, should expect the occultists of the white path to give him instruction for the development of his own egotistical self. They do not take the slightest interest in the felicity of the individual man. Each can attain that for himself, and it is not the task of the white occultists to shorten the way, for they are only concerned with the development and liberation of all human beings and all creatures. Their instructions, therefore, deal only with the development of powers for collaboration in this work. Thus they place selfless devotion and self-sacrifice before all other qualities. They never actually refuse anyone, for even the greatest egotist can purify himself, but no one merely seeking an advantage for himself will ever obtain assistance from the white occultists. Even when they do not refuse their help, he, the seeker, deprives himself of the advantage resulting from their assistance. Anyone, therefore, really following the instructions of the good occultists will, upon crossing the threshold, understand the demands of the greater guardian. Anyone, however, not following their instructions can never hope to reach the threshold. Their instructions, if followed, produce good results or no results, for it is no part of their task to lead to egotistical felicity and a mere existence in the supersensible worlds. In fact, it becomes their duty to keep the student away from the supersensible world until he can enter it with a will for selfless collaboration. Appendix on page 260. That was the end of chapter 10. The path to supersensible knowledge, as described in this book, leads the soul through experiences concerning the nature of which it is especially important to avoid all illusions and misconceptions. Yet it is but natural that the latter should arise in such questions as are here considered. In this connection, one of the most serious mistakes occurs when the whole range of inner experience dealt with in true spiritual science is distorted into appearing in the same category as superstition, visionary dreaming, mediumship or spiritism, and other degenerate practices. This distortion is often due to the fact that persons desirous of following the path described in this book are confused with others who, in their search for supersensible reality, and as a result of methods foreign to a genuine striving for knowledge, wander into undesirable paths. The experiences through which the human soul lives on the path here described are wholly confined to the realm of psycho-spiritual experience. They are only possible if equal freedom and independence from the bodily life are attained for certain other inner experiences, as is the case during ordinary consciousness, when thoughts are made concerning things outwardly perceived or inwardly felt and willed, thoughts which do not themselves originate in what is perceived, felt, and willed. There are people who deny the existence of such thoughts. They believe that no thought is possible that is not extracted from perceptions or from the inner life dependent on the body. For them, all thoughts are, to a certain extent, mere reflections of perceptions and of inner experiences. This view, however, can be expressed only by those who have never raised themselves to the faculty of experiencing with their souls a self-sustaining life in pure thought. For others who have lived through this experience, it is a matter of knowledge that wherever thought dominates the life of the soul to the degree that this thought permeates other soul functions, the human being is involved in an activity in whose origin his body has no share. In the ordinary life of the soul, thought is almost always mixed with other functions, perception, feeling, willing, and so forth. These other functions are effectuated by the body, yet thought plays into them. And to the degree that it does this, a process takes place in and through the human being in which his body has no share. This can only be denied so long as the illusion is not discarded, which arises from observing thought only when the latter is united with other functions. Yet an inner exertion is possible which will enable the thinking part of inner life to be experienced as distinct from everything else. Something consisting in pure thought alone can be detached from the encompassing soul life, that is, thoughts that are self-sustaining and from which everything provided by perception or bodily conditioned inner life is excluded. Such thoughts reveal themselves, through what they are as spiritual supersensible substance. Anyone uniting himself with them, while excluding all perception, all memory, and every other token of inner life, knows himself to be in a supersensible region and experiences himself outside the physical body. For anyone familiar with this whole process, the question can no longer arise. Can the soul live through experiences outside the body in a supersensible world? For it would mean denying what he knows from experience. The only question for him is, What prevents such a positive fact from being recognized? And the answer he finds to this question is that the fact does not reveal itself unless the student first cultivates a condition of soul which allows him to become the recipient of this revelation. Now, people become at once suspicious when an activity confined entirely to the soul is expected of them, in order that something independent of themselves should reveal itself. They believe that they themselves give the revelation its content because they prepare themselves to receive it. They expect experiences to which they contribute nothing and which allow them to remain quite passive. Should such people, in addition, be ignorant of the simplest scientific requirements for the comprehension of a given fact, they will take for an objective revelation of non-sensible substance, contents and productions of the soul in which the soul's conscious participation is reduced below the level maintained in sense perception and will-impelled action. Such are the soul contents provided by the experiences and revelations of the visionary and the medium. But what comes to the fore through such revelations is not a supersensible, but a subsensible world. Human waking life does not run its course completely within the body. The most conscious part of it runs its course on the boundary between the body and the physical outer world. Thus the process of perception with the organs of sense is as much an extra-physical process penetrating into the body as a permeation of this process from out the body. So too is the life of will, which rests upon the insertion of the human being into the cosmic being, so that what occurs in the human being through his will is simultaneously a link in the chain of cosmic occurrence. In this life of the soul, running on the boundary of the physical body, the human being is to a high degree dependent on his physical organization. But the function of thought plays into this activity, and inasmuch as this is the case, the human being makes himself independent of his bodily organization in the functions of sense perception and willing. In the experiences of the visionary and in mediumistic phenomena, the human being becomes completely dependent on his body. He excludes from the life of his soul that function which in perception and willing makes him independent of his body. Thus the content and productions of his soul are merely revelations of his bodily life. The experiences of the visionary and the phenomena produced by the medium owe their existence to the fact that a person, while thus experiencing and producing, is, with his soul, less independent of his body than in ordinary perception and willing. In the experience of the supersensible, as indicated in this book, the development of soul life proceeds in just the opposite direction from that taken by the visionary and the medium. The soul acquires a progressively greater independence of the body than is the case in perceiving and willing. The same independence realized in the experience of pure thought is attained by the soul for a far wider range of activity. For the supersensible activity of the soul, here meant, it is especially important to grasp and realize in the clearest possible way this experience of life in pure thought. For in the main, this experience is already a supersensible activity of the soul, but one in which nothing supersensible is as yet perceived. With pure thought, we live in the supersensible, but we experience only this in supersensible fashion. We do not yet experience anything else supersensibly. And supersensible experience must be a continuation of that life already attained by the soul when united with pure thought. For this reason, it is so important to gain knowledge of this union in the right way. For it is from its comprehension that light shines forth to bring correct insight into the nature of supersensible knowledge. The moment the life of the soul sinks below the level of clear consciousness existing in thought, the soul is on the wrong path as far as true knowledge of the supersensible world is concerned. For the soul is seized by the bodily functions, and what is then experienced is not the revelation of a supersensible world, but bodily revelations confined to the subsensible world. Number two, having penetrated to the sphere of the supersensible, the soul's experiences are of such a nature that descriptive expressions cannot so easily be found for them as for experiences confined to the world of the senses. Care must often be taken not to overlook the fact that to a certain extent in descriptions of supersensible experience, the distance separating the actual fact from the language used to describe it is greater than in descriptions of physical experience. The reader must be at pains to realize that many an expression is intended as an illustration, merely indicating in a delicate way the reality to which it refers. Thus it is said on page 19 of this book, quote, "Originally all rules and teachings of spiritual science were expressed in a symbolical sign language," unquote. And on page 82, a, quote, "certain writing system," quote, was mentioned. Now anyone may easily be led to suppose that such a writing system can be learned in the same way we learn the letters of an ordinary physical language and their combinations. In this connection, it must be pointed out that there have been and there still are spiritual scientific schools and associations possessing symbolical signs by means of which supersensible facts are expressed. And anyone initiated into the meaning of these symbols attains thereby the means of directing his inner life toward the supersensible realities in question. But what is of far greater importance for supersensible experience is that in the course of that supersensible experience to which the realization of the contents of this book leads, the soul should, in the contemplation of the supersensible, gain the revelation of such a writing through personal experience. The supersensible says something to the soul which the soul must translate into these illustrative signs so that it can be surveyed with full consciousness. The statement can be made that what is imparted in this book can be realized by every soul. And in the course of this realization, which the soul can personally determine according to the indications given, the resulting events occur as described. Let the reader take this book as a conversation between the author and himself. The statement that the student needs personal instruction should be understood in the sense that this book itself is personal instruction. In earlier times, there were reasons for reserving such personal instruction for oral teaching. Today, we have reached a stage in the evolution of humanity in which spiritual scientific knowledge must become far more widely disseminated than formerly. It must be placed within the reach of everyone to a quite different extent from what was the case in older times. Hence the book replaces the former oral instruction. It is only to a limited extent correct to say that further personal instruction is necessary beyond that contained in this book. No doubt someone may need assistance, and it may be of importance for him or her, but it would be false to believe that there are any cardinal points not mentioned in this book. These can be found by anyone who reads correctly, and above all, completely. Number 3. The descriptive instructions given in this book appear at first sight to require the complete alteration of the whole human being. Yet when correctly read, it will be found that nothing more is intended than a description of the inner soul state required of anyone in those moments of life at which he confronts the supersensible world. He develops this state of soul as a second being within himself, and the healthy other being pursues its course in the old way. The unfolding trainee knows how to hold the two beings apart in full consciousness and how to make them act and react on each other in the right way. This does not make him useless and incompetent for life, nor does he lose his interest and skill in it and become a spiritual researcher the whole day long. It is, of course, true that the student's manner of experience in the supersensible world will shed its light over his whole being, but far from distracting him from life, it makes him more capable and his life more productive. The necessity of adopting the existing method of description is due to the fact that every cognitive process directed toward the supersensible calls the whole human being into action, so that in the moment of such cognition, the whole human being is engaged. In the process of color perception, the eye alone, with its adjoining nervous system, is engaged, while the supersensible cognitive process engages the whole human being. The whole human being becomes an eye or an ear. For this reason, when information is given concerning the construction of supersensible cognitive processes, it appears as though a transformation of the human being were meant, as if nothing were right in the ordinary human being, and he should become quite different. Number 4. I should like to add to what was said on page 131, et sec, whatever that is, concerning, quote, "some results of initiation," unquote, something which, with a slight alteration, can apply to other parts of the book. It may occur to someone to ask whether such figurative descriptions are necessary, and whether it would not be possible to describe these supersensible experiences in ideas without such illustrations. In reply, it must be pointed out that for the experience of supersensible reality, it is essential that the human being know himself as a supersensible being in a supersensible world. Without this vision of his own supersensible nature, whose reality is fully manifest in the descriptions here given of the lotus flowers and the etheric body, the human being's experience of himself in the supersensible world would be like placing him in the sensible world in such a way that the things and processes around him manifested themselves, while he himself had no knowledge of his own body. His perception of his own supersensible form in soul body and etheric body enables him to stand conscious of himself in the supersensible world just as he is conscious of himself in the physical world through the perception of his physical body. The end. The book Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment by Rudolf Steiner.